then we deal with those two, and we, if we agree as members, we'll push up that law, then we'll read the motion and the report of the committee, and then that will be the end of the meeting. Our meeting was scheduled from 10 to 10:30, 10:45. As the committee will be having another meeting from 10:45 to 18:00. Having said that, I'll welcome everybody. I think we'll be meeting now and then. We don't have a new person to be introduced, unless when you want to speak and introduce yourself. I'm now going to hand over to Advocate Quetta to take us through all those issues that were left last week. Over to you, Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. And Chair, as we stated, we
will not... Maybe, so maybe before that, for record purposes, let us still read the apologies of members of the committee before we start. Ariko?
Thank you, Chair. We received apologies from three members, Mr. Lomula, Mr. Suleiman, and Mr. Kani. Those are the only three apologies we received.
Very much, and also to welcome the chair of the board and the board members. Thank you very much. Over to you, Patrick.
Thank you, Chair. And Chair, we are dealing with the documents titled Proposed Amendment to the Freedom of Publication Amendment Bill 7B of 2006. This document has been amended from the previous document, but I will not go into all the other issues that we agreed upon at the last meeting. But before I go into the new proposal, Chair, I'd like to point out to the committee that on page 3 of the particular document, Chair, at the bottom. Page 3 of, on clause 21, point number 5 at the bottom. This is a new edition. It's only a constitutional amendment, like the one that discussed last week, that we have to remove visual presentations or the descriptions or presentations of or amounted to. It was just outlined to you. It's just a technical amendment. The other technical amendment that we have introduced here is on page 4, point number 6. In this subsection 6, Chair, there were some words that were left out. We're on page 4 of the document. On point number 6, the point top. It is under no change, it will be under 12:21, page 4. There were some words that were left out due to typing error, Chair. We just included those words. There's no change to the substance and the clause. It has been removed from clause 27, Chair, up to now to 12:21. Nothing to change that, it's something to adjust out, Chair. I don't want to read out the word to adjust out. The clause that says a broadcaster is subject to regulation by the Independent Communication Authority of South Africa, shall, comma, for the purpose of broadcasting, comma, be exempt from the duty to apply for classification. The word of adjust out, Chair, continuing. Of a game or film and shall, in relation to a film or game, not be subject to any classification. This is the way that we are taking into account, Chair. Otherwise, the provision is the same as the provision in 1227 that we have removed.
Is there not coming to a new proposal that we can?
Money. meeting for the people who arrange committee meeting.
Teacher M plus 4, that is for 4 years post-matric qualification. teachers with 3 years post-matric qualification, and the residual teachers that is M plus one and M two. And we have moved down from about 88,000 in 1996 to about 14,000. And then the senior and master teacher that just recognizes experience in the system. The second leg of the classroom education is now I want to remain in a classroom, do I just remain a teacher? Is a specialist educator, which is new. Teaching and learning specialist is equivalent to a head of department position, and a number of these posts will be created at the school level. So if a school has 7 head of departments, an average 6 secondary school, they will then be allocated 7 teaching and learning specialist posts. They are not empty posts, they are posts that can be converted to teaching and learning, and current staff at the school, if they qualify, in terms of 10 years of experience, in terms of an RQV 15 or matric plus 5 years qualification, part of the negotiation delay was that our proposal was that the RQV 15 had to be an honors qualification in the specialist subject that you are teaching. Now we understand that currently that would be difficult to be able to meet, but the intention is eventually that these specialist educators, if you are a math specialist educator, you should have an honors degree in mathematics or the teaching of mathematics. You can become a senior teaching learning specialist with 14 years of experience, RQV 16, equivalent to a master's, or 6 years training on top of your matric, and you must have had outstanding performance. Also, what does these posts mean? The number of senior teaching, learning, and specialist equivalent deputy will also be allocated to the school in relation to the number of deputy principal posts that exist at the school. I must say, Chair, that these posts, as I indicated, are not new posts. They upgraded posts. So that if you have a school currently where you have teachers that qualify, they will then be upgraded, subject to an external evaluation and assessment, to this particular level. So we don't go to the normal promotion procedure, recommendations by governing body, etc. These educators must also demonstrate that they provide leadership in learning and teaching, that they participate in school, community, educational, local, regional education activities. For example, lots of educators chair subject committees, they develop materials, etc. Then we look at the school-based management, including education management service. We have what is now called the education management service. And the education management service consists of the head of department, that is our school-based, the head of department, the deputy principal. Let me separate. School-based management is head of department, deputy principal, principal. And the education management service is the head, deputy principal and principal. The head of department is at the point of confluence between the teacher and management, and so they're not just counted as part of the management service. Now, what does the management service entail? It means that you are being able to get a flexible remuneration package. Secondly, you must sign a performance agreement. In terms of the performance agreement, there are certain key performance areas in which you undertake to deliver on. And you will not be able to get your increments if those performance agreements are not signed. And they are also externally evaluated. Now we finish with the school. There's a teaching and learning general classroom, the specialist, and the management. Now we go to office space. There's two streams here. Specialist, education specialist, curriculum developers and so forth, and managers, circuit managers, etc. The specialists have the same job description, titles as previously: education specialist, senior education specialist, deputy chief education specialist, chief education specialist. The management consists of two legs. One is the institution manager, so your circuit manager to do management work, and the head of the district, which we don't deal with in this terms of this agreement because head of district are mostly FNS members. Share new issues that are addressed in the OSD. And this is what part of the issue that around reaching an agreement. We were not willing to move forward if some of these fundamental principles were not acceded to. Number one, external moderation will be used in all cases where educators are assessed on the level of good and outstanding for accelerated progression and teaching specialist post appointment. Non-negotiable. Secondly, letter performance will form part of the assessment of education. Now, see, this took significant time and effort. I mean, you know, you get all research from it, you go in the world, as it were, the issue of context. Our starting point is that if a teacher makes a difference in the classroom, if a teacher makes a difference to a learner, and if we can measure that difference, let's measure it and see. We can talk about the scale of that difference, but we cannot say that a teacher does not and can never make a difference, and that we can never measure the difference. We may have difficulties in what measuring tools to use and what measuring instruments to use, but we can never say that we can never measure learner progress. Now the challenge in the process issue is going to be how to. We say that it will form part of an assessment. It is not that all your learners must pass at 100% and therefore you will get the performance. But we want to see that there is a demonstrable change in learners. Then educators will have to keep portfolios of evidence where they want to be assessed as good and outstanding and prove evidence-based that they are the good and outstanding educators. The next point is that, again, that we had, we got stuck on, and you can see we got stuck on these issues of quality. Managerial competency, curricular competency, and improvement of qualifications were the basis for new requirements for appointments, upgrading, and promotion. We really got stuck on the issue of managerial competency. And we said, well, if you need to be a manager, you must know how to manage. Part of it, we said, is experience in management. You can't appoint a person that's a principal that never had any either managerial experience or any managerial competence. Oh. Then it's probably a long version. By 2013, all teachers, and this is a moratorium, because we had insisted that initially all teachers will get only the OSD if they are at a particular level of qualification, and the minimum would have been RQ 14, that they then grow into the OSD. However, all educators will be able to benefit from this progression system. However, 2013 is a cut-off date by which all teachers need to still or upgrade their qualifications. And the minister did mention in the budget speech that we will make funds available in order to be able to do that. There are just a range of educators, of considered educators, that are not part of this agreement. And they are psychologists, therapists, and counselors, AVET educators, and educators in the FGP sector. The reason why psychologists, therapists, and counselors are not included is that now that we're moving to an occupation-specific dispensation, it would mean that their occupation, there must be an occupation package for them. And that is managed by the Department of Health. And they have not yet finalized their occupation-specific dispensation for health professionals, as they call them. AVET educators, we're re-looking at the whole AVET system, the system of delivery, and once that delivery system has been developed, and the way that AVET educators are to be utilized, we'll come up with new policies for AVET educators. And educators in the FET sector are no longer our employees. However, it will be up to the employers of the FET personnel, that is college council, to propose to us a similar or even better OSD so that the FET sector becomes responsive. And we will be looking forward to creative ideas from the from different councils. So clearly, I'll take a few minutes, and I know many of us don't like the complicated things, but I'll take some time, and I'll just use an example of what currently, if we take a teacher at, can we see them up here? Let's take this teacher at M plus 3. Let the teacher 3-year diploma. What does the teacher earn currently? Minimum salary structure is 132,000. Sorry, let me use this F plus. Let me use the teacher F plus 4. Current minimum salary is 107,000 currently. The new OSD, they will move up to 170,000. So that's what currently, that's what they will move up to immediately on translation. Now let's look at what's the maximum you can reach in your career. Currently, an M plus 4 educator can reach 184,248. Performing at the factory level, reaching this particular salary level. However, under the OSD, and it took 16 years to reach this, under the OSD, minimum is 117, the maximum salary is 215,000. And members of the this is without benefits, but 250,000 basic salary, that is for satisfactory service. Now it's true that if a teacher studying this year will take 35 years to reach this. But we must compare this in real terms at the same point in time of the 184 one can reach. However, we can extend it maximum by 71% of the current, by 71% of the current, to 263,280 on good and outstanding performance. So they can actually extend. So if somebody performs outstanding, there's an opportunity. If you are outstanding in the system, that you will be rewarded. It will not be one in the same. And those are similar examples. Now let's look at the teacher remaining in a classroom. Not doing management work, that's the teaching and learning specialist. Equivalent to an A2D level. The currently, as a teacher, you can move up to a maximum 168,252. Currently doesn't exist, but the minimum is 168. Mm-hmm. But it's also currently, because it doesn't opportunity, the most you can get is 184. But now, as a teacher, you can move up to 365,000. Basic. At the end of your career. So I just want to make it very clear, at the end of your career. So there doesn't be expectations that tomorrow people are going to learn this. And the same thing for senior teaching and learning specialists, 395,000. See, I'm not going to go into this particular scale, but you can, if you just look at the opportunities for principals of where they can be moving from a principal of a large school. From the current maximum salary of 322, there is potential and opportunity to move to 446. We must also remember that a lot of our educators have been in the system, have reached the maximum. What this OSD does is that it removes that ceiling immediately, and from now to the end of the career, you can start progressing. There are teachers that have reached the maximum under the old system who never have seen any movement up and down. And these are offered to make educators. Here, then in concluding, the NRC collective agreement 2 We agreed that some of the issues were complex and required more time. These include, among other things, establishing a task team to look at a number of issues that I will come up to. The task team is made up of the employer and the two combined trade unions in the ERRC, SATU and SAUL. So the other issues for investigation are the education management service issue, that means the conversion of the flexible package. How much? 70%, 75%? The requirements for appointment as learning, teaching, senior learning and teaching specialist. Now we have a position on this, it's quite clear. The unions want to perhaps table other proposals on it. Our basis is that you must be having an educational teaching qualification, relevant qualification in learning and teaching to be able to move into this position. We think if you did an LLD and you want to become a senior specialist in mathematics, it's not relevant. We wanted to make it a minimum requirement, however, we said that up to 2013 we can give an opportunity for people to upgrade themselves. However, currently we will recognize if you've got 5 years added on to your mistake. So that's the thing that we have to stretch out. Teacher assessment. Now, I'm not sure, we've agreed in principle in the OSD. We will hear that the union say they haven't agreed, but we've agreed. The learner, in terms of teacher assessment, learner assessment will form part of it. The issue is the how. What do we measure? If it's a primary school, there's no particular result, how do we measure that? We said that we have to look at the proxy indicators in terms of learning and teaching. Clearly, if the curriculum requires you to write 5 essays and you don't have a word for 5 essays, then it's in a sense. It's a starting point around this particular issue. The ERRC also to investigate the impact of OLD on PAM. PAM is the personal administration manager. So how the personal administration manager has to be amended. If there are other provisions of system, their conflicts are always being, they would have to be fixed up. The ERRC is to investigate the possibility of a study visit to look at other structures. The research must be completed by June 2008. And then the ERRC is to investigate the methodology of teacher training and development by September 2008. That is, how do we commit ourselves as the state together with our partners to ensure that all our educators reach that new minimum qualification by 2030, and what funding resources do we put into the program? I indicated to members about the Purcell system, but what the system will also do is each teacher will have their salary history available from Purcell, and they can go into it, and if they find that there are any anomalies, we've agreed that we will address them and look into them, because the unions have been saying that previous agreements have not been properly implemented, and we can bring proof to us around this particular process, and we are compelled to rectify it when necessary. So this will assist. We are in the process of finalizing the management plan and all other processes to be finalized at this point. Thank you.
Chair, this is an outstanding piece of work. It's taken quite some time, and at some point there seems to it had appeared as if deadlocks between the department and the teacher union were imminent. But I think the department has to be congratulated that they steered the whole thing through and passed the very many pitfalls that there were. and I think this is the basis for, a salary dispensation that will last for a long time and will also address the issues of educators. Now, Chair, I believe that one of the big debates when the salary, occupation-specific dispensation was negotiated, revolved around the issue of learner performance. And I'm not sure, but, I can be indicated whether in terms of learner performance, the issue of, I know at some point the issue of the results of learners, exam results of learners were outlined as one of the criteria. And I know that one of the arguments of the unions that in terms of learner performance and the results, that was linked very strongly to the resources at particular schools, and that you may find that the learner performance and the exam results of learners who were at better resourced schools would be better than the performance of learners and their exam results at worse resource schools. And the argument that further goes that, in terms of the better resource schools, those would be your former model C schools, and that your schools in the really areas of the poorest of the poor, your no-fee schools in particular, where there were not as much resources, that the performance of learners and the exam results will be worse there and would therefore have an adverse effect on how those educators who are at those schools would qualify for promotion salary-wise in terms of learner performance. And I'd like the department to respond to that particular point. Thank you, Chair.
My second, in fact, is a comment. The introduction of the education management service, it's a good thing, which is in line with the current practice of payment in based on performance. One issue which is of concern here is this, that this in fact is cascading the whole issue of the performance agreements, or what we call the senior management service, which was introduced in 2000 in the public sector. Now, there have been a number of challenges around that. That now, since the introduction of the system, a number of senior managers, starting from head of departments, chief directors and directors, were not in a position to sign agreements. I did make that reference in the budget debate, which is a serious challenge. I'm a bit covered. I did make some investigation with the National Department of Education, where all senior managers have signed the agreement. And the information I received is quite encouraging, and commend the department on that. But having said that, according to the Public Service Commission study, which was conducted 2 years back, 50% of senior managers from the provincial department did not sign performance agreement. And that's a big, big, big challenge. Not only that they did not sign it, but those who have signed actually is simply a strategy, you know, complying. You know. Now this is very disturbing. I know of some provinces where I can give a breakdown, you know, the Eastern Cape and Northwest, you know. And in some instances, some senior managers were even given, you know, a notch adjustment without being subjected to annual review, and let alone like the signing. So I think this will be a big challenge to the department. And what we want to appeal is that, well, from the Public Service and this committee, we're going to help those executive authorities to account. But as far as education is concerned, we will appeal to you that in MINEC, is an issue to address this. Because it would be, we cannot expect, you know, managers at the lowest level, at the school level, to be subjected to performance agreements when HODs and chief directors for more than 6 years have been unable. And this is a very, very critical reform in our public service, so that now we're able to hold, you know, the senior management, you know, because they provide the management leadership on the top, you see. Now, if they themselves don't actually give, you know, evidence, we'll have some resistance. So I think it's a challenge that needs to be taken on board, because this is very, very important. We expect everybody to perform. So I just wanted to make that observation, and I hope that this issue will be taken upon. From us as a portfolio committee, Public Service, we're going to hold those chief directors and HODs and some of the executive authorities to explain why this is, because this is mandatory from the cabinet. So this is an important improvement, and we welcome it if we can just cut out those problems.
I got my name. Thank you, Chairperson. The Dimtembu has actually touched on the issue, one of the issues I wanted to touch. Indeed, the senior managers should actually lead by example. They cannot expect junior people that they supervise to be actually assessed when they themselves don't go through the same process. However, the other question here is accelerated pay progression is done every 24 months. I want to find out if there's a reason for doing it after so long. Can't it be annual? And the other one is the 1% which a teacher gets for satisfactory performance. I want to find out if this is done internally, a teacher by another teacher in the same school, and not by an external person who could be neutral, because within the same school system, it's likely to be abused. If a teacher doesn't like you, no matter how good you are, you may not get it, and it might also be given to people who do not deserve it because they are good friends. And the other one is, how does the salary scale, the new salary scale, benefit the experienced teachers? I see here it's only M+1, M+2, principals, M+3, and so on and so on. But the teachers who have been in the system for too long and for good experience, I think the paper is silent about them, unless if maybe it's an oversight on my part. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. and the union too, because it goes a long way in bringing the peace into protest and but more commendable is the recognition of the principle of the total bargaining. Clearly a shift from one side fit all in the public service. Also very commendable. But what concerns me, you know, I don't get it clear here, you know, what measures you have put in place or are putting in place to implement this career passing. We've been talking about this thing for half a decade, you know, and there is no clear movement in it. The next issue, which is perhaps related to finance, respond or not, no. You indicated that will benefit 5/12 of the increment. Obviously, if the salary taxes are blocked, the teacher will be hard hit, no. Over a thing that should have been spread over no 5 previous months. But I understand that's not your domain, no. If you need to respond or not. The 2 yearly pay progression based on that performance. I understand the principle of 2 years. You know. Evaluate the teacher with the time, you know, and the resources to evaluate him. But what I would like to know, are we fairly confident that we have put measures in place at the operational point, provinces and districts, that this thing happens? Because there have been many paper agreements that have not been honored. What measures are you putting in place to ensure that it does happen? Then the next issue is related to the benchmarks themselves. How are we making sure that these benchmarks are effectively communicated to teachers? They must not expect what is expected to them. I don't think it's quite correct that the whole thing can be left to unions. The employer has got the responsibility to make sure that the message reaches the destination. Then finally, there's the issue of this external moderation, which is quite correct. Will the capacity be there in the district, or are you going to outsource this process, or are you going to be with a twin approach, district and external evaluators? And the related training then, so that the teachers must perceive that the evaluation is fair. So we move away from this old negative connotation of the inspectorate. The issue of letter performance obviously is a thing where we need further clarity. How do you look at the situation given the fact that there are persistent inequalities in our education system? The haves and the haves, you know, and the poorly resourced groups.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is on the other proposition for salary. Here I see this one on the my concern here is the way different in most cases, these principals or school governing boards, they choose maybe prefect or maybe their friends to those schools. And you find that maybe we got some evidence where you find that a principal in that school got a relative whom she or he ensures that that person gets to mine is just to check whether how are you going to handle that issue and then also to check on incompetent principals because here we are saying Leonard Simon, but what about the consensus which we are having present?
For me, it could be easier to do it with school dancing. I'm putting my constituency cap on it. In page 14, your principal update on based on creating of school. I want to believe that creating of school refers to the number of teachers, the number of learners, the number of. What I follow is in my context is the high school whereby it's ratio being in the transfer the school high school started grade test. Therefore the principal has only three but 10 level terms, which means therefore he cannot have many teachers. He cannot have many learners. When you compare with the principal in other regions, where the high school starts at grade 8. The clerical can start at grade 8, it means more levels and more teachers. How do you accommodate it? Well, it's no fault of theirs. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members, for both the accolades and the comments and the questions. Chair, it's correct that the big debate is about learner achievement. And the issue did come up about resources. I mean, that matter has come up. And clearly, that's why we use the word a relative performance, or performance within context, and we talk of proxies for achievement. Now, what we're saying is that it is not that resources notwithstanding, we can never start off from a point that says that we can never measure learner achievement until we reach a minimum level of resourcing. According to whose definition, I'm sure it's difficult to determine. Because the level of resourcing in education is never enough, or considered particularly enough. But if we look at a minimum level of resourcing, we're already spending, in terms of our national budget, over 100 billion rand. I mean, that's resources that are going into the education. But perhaps when we're talking about additional resources like learning materials, facilities, etc. But I think the challenge would be, and the issue of context has always been recognized, that we take context into account. We know what curriculum outcomes are. We know that some of these outcomes can be achieved by plain simple teaching, and that they don't perhaps require sophisticated curriculum resources. So our challenge would be to create those benchmarks, those minimum outcomes, communicate to them. Chair, simple foundational basic issues. If you are teaching in a primary school, are those learners able to read, write, and calculate at that basic particular level? If in terms of our assessments that we have done, the international assessments, where we are really scoring very, very bad, bottom of the particular level, clearly. So that's our starting point. We're not talking about 100% achievement, scoring at 100% or being in the top quintile. See, it would be up to the school manager, the school principals to begin to show how the context and the situation is affecting that. So the answer of better resource schools versus less resource schools, this context will have to be taken into account. I also indicated that we look at growth in performance. If learners performed at level A this year, and next year that level has increased, even if it's by 10% as a growth, even although it's a low base, let us recognize that particular growth, this growth and this particular effort happening. So I think that goes the same thing in terms of, yes, it's true, it's the challenge in terms of the criteria. And that's what the second process is going to be tough. Fortunately, we do have time on our side in terms of the implementation issue. And the time that we have on our side is that the first time that we have to apply these particular issues is around 2010. It's to both the systems, the training, etc. So I'm responding to the other question. Performance agreements in terms of the public service commission, that is for other managers, we have 3 months in the start of the financial year to complete that. So all departments, all managers should have signed and submitted, signed off by the executing authority by June. However, that goalpost was moved in that we've been asked to complete by end of May. The Department of Education had completed almost 90% of it by end of March, and by the end of April, 100% of the performance agreement has been signed. In addition to that, all managers are also required to submit the disclosure of income forms, and 100% of that has already been completed on the 1st of April. Those have been completed. Chair, we will take it back to the department, and we will, although the monitoring of performance agreements in provinces is done by the public, by the DPSA, through the provincial DGs, who are responsible for that and who do sit on cluster meetings. We will take the initiative as the Department of Education, take a report on education managers within the provinces, and we will give a report to the minister on that. So we will take that up. In terms of the 1% satisfactory, and whether the evaluation is done internally or by a neutral person, we have the IQMS agreement, which starts off from a point of a development process of identifying your own needs and your own requirements in terms of your learning and teaching. Because you are at best to be able to diagnose this particular issue. And to look at where the development gaps are. There's the process of the departmental team, which is a group of professionals, yes, other teachers in the school. By the end of the day, the principal and the manager have a separate accountability around that process. So the principal has to take their responsibility and say that I am too afraid to deal with teachers. I am too afraid to exercise my professional judgment, and I'm too afraid to question those assessments that come up to me. Then clearly the issue is that that responsibility will be has to be taken. Now, it can clearly happen when none of the teachers are satisfactory. The principal signs off on it. But what we're saying is that the system we're putting is that one day you're going to be caught. You're going to be caught because as a principal you need a performance agreement. You're going to be caught because we're assessing school results. You're going to be caught because we're starting an expansion of external evaluation. So time is the issue that will take up. Clearly we had a chicken and egg situation. Do we put all the systems in place, get the performance, get everything in place, and then say we reward you? Or do we start with a form, with a structure? So we know we're going to have initial particular issues, but we say, we've got a structure in which it assists us in saying that it, now the salary structure is unquestionable. You know, often teachers say, no, you're expecting A, B, and C, but we're not remuneration really properly. So the issue is that that's satisfactory because there are 350,000 educators. It's impossible to get that many external people to do those particular issues in a year, even if you visit one teacher, a year is 350 days. Secondly, all international practices have shown that I can give the most wonderful lesson to you on that one day. I can keep all the lessons prepared in my cupboard and then collect them until I know you're coming, and I will. So it defeats itself. The issues to grow the professionalism, the school-based issues. What we have done is that in terms of the school-based IPMS, it's not thrown out of the window. We said this is a very, very important instrument for you to measure and for you to tell us what your development needs are. We have just appointed a chair in our budget, which we were allocated in 2007-08, but which we had challenges in finalizing the appointment. We have just appointed and starting on the 1st of June will be 84 people employed by the Department of Education, not by provinces, who will be going out to schools, who will be assessing the implementation of the IQMS, except I don't remember saw the big advertisement in a newspaper. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the satisfactory issue, I'm saying it is a tool that the principal must use. It is a tool where people are not performing satisfactorily. They cannot say, I don't have a tool in which to deal with that particular issue. The issue of experienced educators, I must say that the debates in the negotiations are as follows. Union said, count the number of years teachers are teaching, and then if a teacher is teaching 5 years, give them, say, 5 notches. If they're teaching 15 years, give them 15 notches. But what we're saying is that experience has been built into previous salary agreements. At the time in 1996, because of the compression of scale, what happened is that a teacher teaching 2 years and a teacher teaching 5 years were put on the same notch. Nobody lost salary, except that a teacher teaching 2 years was brought up to the one with 5 years. Now the complaint is, I'm 2 years and you 5 years, we're earning the same. Make a differentiation. And so there's a never-ending story in terms of being able to deal with it. The principle of experience is entrenched in the OLD. As I indicated, if you perform outstanding in terms of the number of years, the longer you stay in the profession, every second year you will gain that 3%. Experienced teachers will also benefit in the terms of which experienced teachers have reached the ceiling, the maximum. What happens is when you reach your maximum after that 16 years is that you don't get accelerated progression. You don't even get performance bonus, the accelerated one. Because you reach your ceiling, even if you perform at outstanding level, you're stuck. We've removed that. And in removing that, that means those experienced teachers, the gates are now open to continue. Measures have been put in place for career pathing. We have had that career pathing. We had the senior and the master educators, but now this OSD institutionalizes it. In other words, it doesn't make it fluffy type of an issue. We say that you can become a specialist learning and teacher specialist, and this will come into effect. This post will be available in 2009 or 2010, as soon as we have an agreement. Unfortunately, we're not going to release these career pathing codes. We've got to reach those minimum agreement around experience, qualification, and performance. I'm not going to comment on the text issue, but in terms of the two-year cycle, is that, and I think the question was answered at the same time. Why every 2 years? The issue is we could have had every year 1.5%, or every 2 years 3%. And the system is just too big and just too large and overwhelming to be able to. So IQMS happens every year in the school. It is not thrown out. It happens every year in the school. It's going to happen. It's going to be moderated. Scores are going to be supplemented. But we have a 2 year cycle in which to receive the scores, moderate the scores, put the development plan in place, to make sure that the salaries are particularly paid. We agree that the benchmarks must be communicated. I answered partly the issue of external moderation. The challenge that is in the provinces, and what we're doing is as part of our budget bit, and Mr. Rebecca is here, we're putting in quite a priority bit in terms of boosting district capacity, district personnel. I think the other performance one I answered. See, I think we must take a firm position. We say education is everybody's business. We must take a firm position that for the amount of money we invest in education, we want a return, and we want to see that. Because in the end of the day, if we relax on this again, we are doing a disservice to the poor, in terms of which we will never measure their outcomes, we will never measure the level of education that they particularly receive. And the issue is importantly about the child. See, I mean, you know, the issue of nepotism, etc., around the promotion post is an issue that I know it happens, it can happen, but we need to find ways and means in terms of dealing with it, either through the dispute mechanism, through the powers of the governing body. But I think we need to perhaps review and relook at governing body posts, of public service posts, where they're entirely left up to the discretion of the governing body to select between a range of candidates with different competencies, different experience. And I think as employers, we must begin to play a greater role in ensuring that people who qualify for promotion meet the minimum requirements. And if you don't meet the minimum requirements, you can't just apply and as a member indicate if you're competent. Share the Eastern Cape situation. I know when you speak about when you speak from the angle of a recipient, that it's unfair that my school cannot grow. The principle around paying principals differentiated salary is about the amount of work that you have to do, the load. Now, your point is valid in the sense that if it means that you aren't able to retain the principal because they want to run away to bigger schools for more salary, then I think that is an issue. And one, we have to look at the incentive scheme of whether to do with it. But the other issue is the policy and school types and structure in the Eastern Cape. The Eastern Cape is unique. And we are engaging with them to begin to look at the uniform school type and school system so that there is some equity around that particular issue. But we are aware of that problem. Thank you, Chair. I think I've covered all, but if I haven't, I'm sure we can come back.
Firstly, I appreciate the last point you made about tightening up the recruitment strategy. Because that's one of the areas where we're having challenges, that the right people should be appointed for a particular vertical. Because that is part of solving some of the challenges. But just to come back to the issue I raised, you see the question of performance agreement is that they should be concluded, you know, before the beginning of the financial year. You know, part of the problem about the implementation of the performance management system is that many senior managers, you know, submit their agreements very late. Now, if you submit your performance agreement in June, well, you know, the financial year started, you know, first of April, then it's problematic, because that is part of your planning as a manager. What deliverables are you going to have on the basis of which you will be compensated and you will also be held accountable? So it's a very, very serious challenge. I've made a point that some of the senior managers, it's simple a strategic compliance, you know, just to adhere with the rules without actually substantive, you know, complying with the context and what is intended, namely to improve, you know, performance results. So I think it is a bit problematic if there are still senior managers who think there's still time to do that, then it means it's just a strategic compliance. I'm saying this thing because I believe strongly that if really this system can be implemented substantively to achieve the desired results, we see some improvements. We see definitely some improvements. And I'm saying this mainly, take for example the issue of this problem by the National Department, if really senior managers can plan that now these targets were set for those targeted areas, these are the deliverables, and then now the outputs, how they will be measured, and then they come into an agreement with the executing authority, and then they're even being held accountable, and they're compensated accordingly, and they get their bonuses. I think if that can be done, we'll really make a big improvement. So I'm definitely passionate about effective implementation of the performance management system, and equally effective implementation of the education management service. Because if they get the leadership at the school level, the leadership at the district level, the political leadership, as well as the management leadership at national level, at provincial level, and all levels, all of us, go to our business, I think we'll make great, great improvement. Thank you.
Why don't we take that up as a comment?
Can I just...
I want to cross over now to the next presentation. I want to cross over. We're supposed to have talked at 5:00. Yeah, the second is my other opportunity. Can you cross over, therefore, to the next one? To the inclusive.
Just to say broadly, our definition of inclusive education in our white paper 6, what it does, it really at the center is the increase of participation for learners, for all learners in the education system, and the reduction of exclusion from local sites of learning. What it does is to put at the center the idea that all learners can learn, but what learners may need are different levels of support. So this is a movement away from what has always obtained in the education system, which was a fairly medical, you know, a focus on the medical definition of a barrier to learning and focus mainly on physical disabilities. And what our policy now does is to say all learners may need support, and you don't focus on physical disability alone, and also with physical disability, a recognition that physical disability can be at various levels. There are people who are completely blind. There are those who are slightly visually impaired, and those people don't all need to be seen, to be put at the same place, and they can be supported differently. What the policy also does is to set a framework for the creation of enabling education structures, systems, and methodologies so that all learners can be catered for. It also acknowledges and respects difference at different levels, and therefore encourages a seeing of barriers to learning that goes beyond physical disability, as I've said. In fact, if I may just quote an example here, I've been accosted many times by somebody who works at Dis-Chem in Centurion, whose child was involved in a car accident and is therefore slightly mentally disturbed. The child has been put in a special school of people with serious intellectual problems, and is unable to cope because the instruction has been put at a level that is way below what he's capable of and could have functioned in the mainstream school. What the policy also envisages then is provision of support and learning to children with disabilities at three different types of schools, or in three different types of schools, in your mainstream, you know, in your public ordinary school, where you provide support to learners at the school, full service school, with where you can cater for children with physical disabilities as well, and in special schools where children need high levels of support. Just very briefly here also to look at what we, you know, we found as we proclaimed the policy. Firstly, it's glaring inequalities in all sections of education, as we know, but especially for children with physical disabilities. Also, what was in place was a parallel system where you have special schools that catered for children with physical disabilities and ordinary education, which benefited, and this model benefited mostly urban and white children. Learners with disabilities in rural areas had no access to education or very limited access, and this obtains today still. There is an estimated 288,000 disabled children of compulsory school going age who are estimated to be out of school. And our current special schools, that are the only places that have been, you know, that in a sense are enabled to cater for these children, have very long waiting lists because we've got very limited learner spaces. In terms of the policy implementation agenda, which is, you know, from 2001 to 2009, there were six key strategies and levers that were identified. Within mainstream schools, it was identifying and converting approximately 500 of the more or less 27,000 schools into full-service schools, starting with primary schools. Secondly, and that was really to expand access, particularly to rural children. Secondly, it was about ensuring that everybody in the system understands the inclusion model, and that by going the inclusive route, you were not then discriminating against children with disabilities. Thirdly, it was to make sure that all children, even those who are outside the system, are catered for. Fourth was the improvement of special schools and ensuring that they were turned into quality centers for learning. But the second element of work in special schools was to convert them to resource centers. The fifth lever was the establishment of district-based support teams to provide a coordinated professional support service to all children. And lastly, it was the development of an implementation of an advocacy and information program. Now, this was very important because at various levels in the system, there was great concern about going this route, which is seen to be overly ambitious. And at the second level is that some parents and children who have benefited from special schools felt that we were going to close down special schools and that their children were therefore not going to be adequately supported. Chair, just to look at those six levers then that we're working on and look at some of, in trying to implement the policy, some of the key challenges and the context in which we were working on. Firstly, this policy was being implemented in the face of serious lack of adequate and appropriate support for learners with disabilities in particular across the system. You know, both in the mainstream system as well as in special schools. Certainly, there was inadequate funding of mainly support to schools which include learners with disabilities. And where there was funding, it was it was not equal. It was inequitable, both within provinces and between provinces. There's a, you know, whole a very serious range that was completely inequitable. Thirdly, special schools mainly were operating in unacceptably poor conditions, particularly those special better schools that serve the poor and the rural. And they suffer seriously from a shortage of properly trained personnel. In fact, if I may say, in many of the special schools serving rural children or serving poor communities, you found that the only thing that was special in those schools was that they were separate from others. You know, the children were put together, but there was no real support. You would find in a special school children with Down syndrome, children who were blind, and children who were deaf, all put together. And we visited one school where children who were deaf were being signed to by the teacher. I mean, who were blind were being signed to by the teacher, because that was the only training that he had. So no grade services and no teacher who could teach grade. Fourth is the lack of appropriate resources and assistive devices for learners, particularly, again, in schools serving the poor. And with no systems for placing learners in special schools. And just to share with the committee that, in fact, it's keeping children in special schools costs almost four times, you know, the place of a learner in an ordinary school. And we found that in many, or we find even now, that in many of these special schools, we have children who have no reason to be there. Children, in fact, who can operate in mainstream schools. Just to say, in this is part of what we are dealing with in the system. In the one key lever that we're using to expand access in rural schools was to turn schools into full-service schools. Now, what we did was to ask provinces to identify the schools for us, and many of the schools of the provinces saw this as an opportunity to get resources to improve schools that they have. And this is a school that has been identified for turning into a full-service school, and this school has virtually nothing, overcrowded, and has no resources. Again, if you see at the corner there, it's a school that's meant to, again, to be a full-service school. Now, to be a full-service school, you're saying you can cater for children who come, who use wheelchairs and all of that, and even the terrain is such that it would be difficult to have a child on a wheelchair going there. Again, this is another school that has been identified by a province as one that needs to be turned into a full-service school. Again, what I'm saying is that some of the schools, as I'm going to talk about progress that we've made, are schools that have, in a sense, that should not have been identified for conversion into full-service schools, because what they need, first of all, are basic resources, basic infrastructural upgrading, before you can convert them into special schools. That is one in the Eastern Cape, Wakonda. This is another one in Limpopo. Again, what we've had to do with this particular school is to rebuild it. You know, sorry, I wanted to show you some of the facilities, the toilets in the school for it to be turned into a full service school. But the inclusion model is, you know, here it is in an urban advantage school, and this is another full service school. And as you can see, resources and the children, and you can see there's a child with Down syndrome there. But this is a school that is well resourced, and where we have seen really some quality provisioning. The main problem here is attitude towards difference, where we're finding that, you know, when you have a child who looks like that, you know, and you can see this is not a very serious case of Down syndrome, but you can see that there's a challenge in accepting the child at the school. Now, Chair, if you'll allow me, although going full service and going inclusion has been our main drive, the critical challenge that we have faced from children from parents who have children with disabilities is what is happening in the special schools, because at the moment, many of the children with physical disabilities are in special schools, and that's why I'd like to talk a little bit about special schools, particularly because there's a mistaken view that we're closing down special schools. Special schools within the inclusive education framework have two roles that are envisaged for them. Firstly, to provide high levels of support so that children who go to special schools should be those children who truly need very high levels of support so that we can concentrate the services that we need and the infrastructural support in those schools. Secondly, if we establish full service schools, we're expecting that special schools ultimately will act as resource centers so that they can provide support to full service schools in the neighborhood that are in their locality, as well as to ordinary schools that accommodate children with disabilities. I have tried to sketch where our special schools are based on our 2002 audit, although it was finalized in 2004, as well as our education set for 2005. As you can see, altogether in the country, we have about 400 special schools serving about 88,000 learners with that number of educators that you see there. I would like to then very briefly sketch, referring to the audit report, and just to share with you briefly some of the findings on special schools that came out in our audit report in 2004. Firstly, we found, as I said, to the lack of spaces for children, but that many of the schools have long lists. Those long waiting lists are not without their problems, because what we've been finding is that even though you will put your child on the waiting list, the admission procedures in many of the schools are very discriminatory. They take children, from particular communities. Secondly, they are inappropriate in that they will take children who don't need to be there, but because the learner pupil ratios are so good in the good schools, that many of the parents will want them there, and they are admitted even though they don't need to be there. But that is, country-wise, there's no uniform policy. Secondly, many of these schools, and again, I keep on my refrain, and the thing that I've been saying all along, that for those serving the poor, still has physical and material neglect, and also many of the schools have no transport facilities. Again, the staffing issues were again, would apply these that are put here again to those schools serving rural communities and the poor. Inadequate preparation of teachers. We have no data. There has been very little data on teacher qualifications, with improving on that, and especially their specialization, which is why you would find in a school serving the blind, no Braille facilities or teachers who are trained in Braille, but teachers only who can use sign levels. Also, their staff establishments are very outdated, and we find too many volunteers in the schools, and not properly trained and permanent teachers, and lack of assistance. In many of the special schools, children need to be assisted with virtually everything, and therefore you need to have assistance. Very limited health professionals, and less lack of classroom support. Fourthly, a thing that was very concerning that came out of the audit was the physical and sexual abuse in many of these schools. Many of them, it is a real matter for concern, but it's related also to limited cost of staff and security. But I think, lastly, the issue of poor quality of teaching and learning. These children have said in many of the special schools there was nothing special in them other than that you've taken your children and put them together as one. Very poor quality of teaching and learning. I'll go back to the question of special schools, but maybe just to say in relation to, that's what we found in special schools, but because this was a key lever in ensuring inclusion and bringing into mainstream children, taking them out of special schools if they didn't need to be there so that they could access quality learning, we have piloted the conversion of 50 strategically placed schools into full-service schools. Again, when I say strategically placed, this is to increase access for rural children and for poor children. And we've used support from the Finnish government, and 10 schools of the 50 are due for completion in 2008, and an additional 20 in 2009. This has been very slow, painfully slow, because of the conditions that I showed you earlier, where schools that were identified needed much more than just conversion. Some of them needed to be rebuilt. We've also put in a screening and identification and assessment system so that we can appropriately place and support learners. Learners who don't need high levels of support to be accommodated in these school service schools, and those who need high levels of support to be put into special schools. And this we've been able to do. I said when I started, we have had many, many challenges with funding, and therefore we've been using mainly donor funds to implement and pilot the policy. And we have been able to train 2,000 teachers on this process of screening and assessment of learners using Swedish funding. But let me focus on special schools again as the second lever, the lever that has been giving us major problems. What we have done within the two-pronged role for special schools, what we have done in approaching them, firstly was to center the creation of quality learning environments, starting with quality hostels, because that has been a major issue, no security, very poor hostels where our children were being raped, to quality learning environments. And what we focus on is to look at the provision of the resources and assistive devices that are needed. This year, we've awarded a 9 million rand tender, which would appoint which would benefit 26 special schools and 12 food service schools, which serve approximately that number of learners. For special schools, we have focused on the training of teachers, mainly in Braille, sign language, and the identification and assessment of learners so that they can be provided with the appropriate support. But more importantly, Chair, from the audit of 2004, 135 schools were identified as being seriously neglected and in need of immediate attention. And for those schools, those we have identified them, and maybe just to share with committee here, that in the 2005-2006 financial year, I think Treasury had given us a special allocation to address specifically these schools. But because the money went to provinces through the provincial equitable share, the money got lost, and therefore the problems that were identified have had to be addressed through provincial budgets, which in most instances have been very limited, and some of the schools have therefore not benefited to the extent that they should have. I want to just very briefly go over what the various provinces have done to deal with the audit. I have a full document for the committee members on the schools that were identified and the problems that were identified in all of the schools for their own monitoring purposes. But in the Free State, what has happened is that they have dealt with those schools as short-term measures. Witumelong and in the Mutewa district, that has been upgraded with additional toilets, I mean classrooms, as well as mobile toilets, and they've spent 5 million rand on that. They've also looked at those two special schools which have received maintenance services amounting to 350,000. A drop in the ocean in relation to the problems that we had identified. In Gauteng, unfortunately, there's no evidence that there has been anything done to deal with the schools that were identified in the province as needing attention. In the Northwest, we have seen very decisive leadership and very decisive interventions, properly structured. This is one province that has really come up to the mark in relation to those schools that were identified. For instance, total improvements to the value of about 15 million, 2007 and 2008, and infrastructure was also prioritized. Renovations in some of those, a new building in a school that needed it, And some of the special schools, because they took the findings very seriously, those schools that they felt just couldn't work and were small, what they did was to merge the schools. But a major problem for many schools serving children with disabilities is a question of transport. And again, we have seen focus on this issue in the Northwest, and all schools, special schools, are receiving scholars, transport subsidies, as well as assistive devices. In Limpopo, again, some attention to the schools, mainly hostels and LTSM, but after the visit of the portfolio committee to one of the schools, I think the province woke up and even the premier got involved, and in that particular school there's been real collaboration and money from the premier's offices, where MDBS is also working in the school, building classrooms and hostels for Ratanang special schools. In Mpumalanga, very minor tinkering here and there. What Mpumalanga has said is that the problem, mainly, particularly because many of the problems in the special schools have related to infrastructure, that their own internal processes in the province made it very difficult for them to make decisive movement and progress. Northern Cape, this is a very strange one, because what we're finding here is that the problem was at a school called Rikamiling. And what we're finding is that the children are being accommodated in a different special school at Elizabeth Kondrazi and provided with transport to go to their school. It is some movement, but we would like to see improvements at the school itself so that the children can be accommodated properly. Another province that has really focused on the findings of the audit has been KwaZulu-Natal, and again, focusing on transport, staff provisioning, ensuring that there is support for the children, teacher aid, as well as looking at additional facilities so that all their children can be accommodated and they can bring in even those children who are currently not accommodated. Western Cape, which has had a history of fairly qualitative provisioning for learners with disability, have also focused on those schools that have been identified as being problematic, but we're not finding major issues in the Western Cape. Eastern Cape, there has been some work that has been done, as indicated on that slide. I think the one thing that I might want to just raise in relation to the Eastern Cape is that for children with mild or moderate mental challenges, the Eastern Cape has closed four of the schools that were supporting, that were providing their support to those learners, contrary to what has been happening in other provinces, where we have found that, in fact, like in the Western Cape, they've actually established four additional facilities to cater for the children, and we're engaging with the Eastern Cape on this matter. Chair, that was dealing with those 135 schools that were identified as being seriously neglected, but we have continued also with the conversion of special schools into resource centers, and safety schools were designated for conversion. And this is so that they don't only provide quality education where they are, but that they can also provide support to others. 26 of them, we believe, have the capacity to become these resource centers in the short term. The additional four will still continue to work with. Many of these schools which serve your deep rural and township schools have a shortage of health professional staff, such as therapists and nurses, and we're looking into that. We are concerned that because of the mix of children who are still being accommodated in these special schools, although we're trying to move those that don't need to be there out, it's a very high percentage of teachers are not trained in the national curriculum statement, and therefore what they do is not prepare the children to deal with the curriculum, but rather to use their hands and stuff. And not all children who are there need that kind of support. Some of them can follow the academic stream. Just to also say, in relation to the work that we and the policy direction of White Paper 6, we are experiencing some resistance in some of these schools, although it's not just these schools, it's these schools and mainstream schools. There is real apprehension at having to change. And therefore, particularly for special schools, there are indications already of some possible challenges with the redeployment of staff, you know, because as you deal with the schools, you sometimes find that the staff is not needed where they are and may be needed elsewhere. Taking the process forward, Chair, we're doing it at two levels. With the special schools, our bid to February seeks to do two things. Firstly, that all of our special schools should meet criteria which we have developed for being fully functional special schools, if they are just going to be special schools. If they are going to be resource centers as well, we looking for funding. Within the bid, we're looking at what it will take to make those schools resource centers. What we've also done, as I said, the previous allocation from Treasury, for some reason got lost, is to prioritize the 135 schools, so that those that have not been dealt with, because the problems in each one of those schools were clearly identified, and we are looking at addressing those. We're prioritizing infrastructure and human resources because we think that's critical. And we're looking at spending no less than 2 million rand per school so that at least they can be of the quality that is needed. Thirdly, we're looking at providing support from these to an increased number of mainstream schools so that children who can be accommodated in mainstream schools can be supported where they are and don't have to be moved away from their families. And again, to look at building specialist support in district-based support teams through the special schools, and strengthen administration management and curriculum support from district offices for these schools to improve coordination at provincial level and strengthen capacity to lead and monitor at the DOE level, because again, we ourselves have been a bit lacking in that regard. Chair, I have focused on special schools, but in terms of mainstream and full service schools, our bid focuses more or less on the same things. It focuses on infrastructure that is appropriate for that level, on human resources that are appropriate, and as well as strengthening the screening of learners so that they can be placed appropriately, assessment of the support that they need, and providing the support that is needed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can I just ask a part of the name? I was taking the figure on page 2. On page 2, the top line. It says that 180,000 is given. Cost compiled by the are estimated to be out of I added that figure to the figure on page 7. That is those I added those two figures. After adding the two figures, I tried to calculate the percentage of those that have been catered for relative to total figures. So I said it's 7,000 plus 80,000. I got a figure. And I took that of those who are there in Kedah and set a 7 days of the Doda. And I got 23%, which remains all that compiled by the age of our school. We are only catering for
because it's a basic category. But to me, this becomes a very serious type. I'm not sure if you as a government are looking at it from that perspective. To say we have a group falling under the compiled by the state who happen to be disabled and who are catering for only to the people. I'm not sure even when we are getting for funding, that is only to see what actually we are facing. Because we did it more than a time. Something that I don't know. I'm not making that comment. It's the end of that. Because in fact, I didn't know that one in 8,000 is not in all of them. Well, some of these kids are hidden. Nobody talks about that. So I'm just pushing back that perspective. If all of us can see to that land and see how serious this problem is. Because this is the group that falls under 15, under compulsion. To be the whole token of why for one person is coming. There's something to matter. It is not just that it's really a problem. Because even if we use our international standards solely, because we're going to go out and get in the world, we will have gone so far to seek access to the climate. While over 70% of our people are staying at home because they are sick. I don't know anyone to comment on that.
I would like to comment here before the other members come in. First, just to say the figure that you see, which is 87,000, that refers to learners who are in special school, not learners who are in school, all of them. You know, so these are the special schools, which are only 400. Now, many of us would know that historically, many of the disabled learners in terms in rural communities, those who go to school, go to mainstream school. They go, I know even from my time that we had children who were mentally challenged who were in the same schools and classes with us. So that doesn't capture all of the children who are there. But the thrust of the policy responds to precisely that. Because the thrust of the policy says not all learners, you see, these children who are in the special schools, or children to be catered for in special schools, should be children who are truly, truly, so seriously disabled that they need high levels of support. The policy says, because of the numbers that we're not reaching, let us firstly ensure that children are placed appropriately, and those who need minimum levels of support can go to either mainstream schools, or if they move, for instance, in wheelchairs, and those mainstream schools cannot do it, that you go to full service schools that will have the ramps that are needed. So what we're doing is really to address that problem, because if you go the special school route, which was the traditional route, then you will not cater for all the children that need to be catered for. And this is to address precisely that, to expand the places that are there. And so I just wanted to say that, because our thrust for dealing with children who need support is not through special schools that, as you can see, can only cater for the numbers that you see there, the almost 90,000. But the other element of the strategy is the advocacy, because some of those children are kept by parents who do not believe that their children can learn and can learn something, particularly in the rural communities. And therefore, that's a key area that we need to drive as a country. I don't know, Feroz has the figures. I'm not very good at figures, but he's got figures here that he might want to respond with.
Well, I'm thinking that one, something that you have identified that there are 288,000 outside. Those 288,000, 10 are in the agency, 7 are in the kids, and blah, blah, blah. and this is the target of putting them in. Whether we take them to normal school or special school, and so that we can go back, say, 5 years from now, even if we have 30,000 more born, we are able to say, we don't have that much, we are outside the system.
I mean, in fact, precisely that's what I needed to say, is that we need to go back to the figures. I think the 288,000 is a figure that was an estimate utilized in the white paper. It was based on the fact that in any normal population, sorry, does it work, but in any population, X percentage of that population will require special services. And then counting the number of learners that we have in our special schools, comparing to that norm, was the issue of that we're not servicing 288. So I just asked Mr. C that we must go back to look at what the estimate is based on. If it's based on services to special, it means that there are learners whose special needs have not been identified, but are in the school system, but in ordinary school. Therefore, in re-looking at those figures and bringing them provincially, I think that's a task we will undertake.
But just to say that based on the census of 2001, and in fact, subsequent, and I know I'm not making my life better by saying that, but subsequent census processes have showed an increase in the children who are outside.
Yeah, Chair, under the audit report 2004, you know, there was a special reference to physical and sexual abuse, physical and sexual abuse often related to shortage of hospital staff, and referring there to 813 reported cases over 3 years. If you just break down that figure, that means just virtually every day there is a learner that is being sexually abused at one of these hostels. Now, quite clearly, you know, I mean, this emphasizes if the problem is shortage of hostel staff, then, you know, our physical planning in terms of physical building need to go hand in hand with human resource provision as well, so that you know, it's so that as we are building hostels in these far-flung places and in rural areas, that the necessary hostel staff, because clearly there are hostels but there's shortage of staff, that one needs to ensure very, very strongly indeed that the necessary staff is there to do the necessary control. You know, I know that often it is these very same members of staff who are guilty of some of this. But I think I just want to make the comment that the two need to go hand in hand in terms of physical provision and human resources.
I'd like to know, just let me know, they also have the say, but understand that we've got some of the charter of the leakage. If we could round up that figure, children who are not in service, 300,000 foreigners, and you could assume that there are 6 million learners in school, somewhere there, spread over grade R to grade 9. That was 75% of children who are just not getting any service. I'm not talking about poor quality. The service is just not there. Now, what you know, becomes a bit more painful, as you know, the DDG was going through a presentation, you see a lot of enthusiasm from poor provinces, like Limpopo, KwaZulu-Natal, and it's not accompanied by similar enthusiasm in comparatively richer provinces like Gauteng and Western Cape. That's a bit disappointing. Now, there are three categories, as we were told. The inclusive schools, full service schools, special schools. Who goes where? We'd like to know so that we can also support where we identify children who need such services. One. Two, are there clear cut classification criteria? This one goes to A school, B school, C school. Have they been effectively communicated to provinces? Now, another concerning issue. Obviously, a big segment of these children can make progress in inclusive schools, because the majority of them, one would assume, you know, might be challenged and so on. Have certain public schools been identified to be such inclusive centers? Because obviously it's costly to offer this service to all these schools. Then the necessary support and training to teachers to prepare this agenda. Because it's a very serious agenda given the fact that you are much behind. And the issue obviously of acceptance of these children by these schools and the children among themselves.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is to appreciate your comment to the department, especially with regard to converting this school to a special center. My question was to say, are they going to be maintenance to ensure that while these schools are used as a resource center to ensure that this other programs don't interfere with the special programs for the kids. And then also to check maybe whether there is any time frame in addressing those challenges mentioned. And then the other one is just to share one experience with the Banaba Tari School, where we've got a number of maybe schools and kids, one of them who is mentally challenged, where the poor child has to stand or to wait from 7 o'clock in the morning or after 6 in the morning until 10, waiting for a bus to collect him or to school. And then also to say, in that Banaba Tari, the community are using their hall as the, for their various activities.
Thank you, Chairperson. Indeed, there still are quite a significant number of children of school-going age who are actually not getting access to education, particularly in deep rural areas, although as well as in some urban areas. And even those who are at these schools, if you visit them, I visited one in Gelukspan in Lichtenberg, you get there, there are no appropriate resources and assistive devices. Children are just taught there, you know, and they're doing hand work and is, you know, taught to do things by, you know, using wools and some reeds and in some cases, not even desks in the classroom. So really, I think there's a lot of work to be done. But now coming back to inclusive education, one would ask a question as to what motivates it. Is it because the government has no capacity to build proper schools for disabled children, who are so many in the country? And are the teachers trained if we want to accommodate such children in normal schools?
we have teachers who are trained to actually use this, trained in the skills such as communication with these children who might be mute and deaf in some cases. And do we, as a department, have made the classrooms accessible for such children? Have we organized transport, because the children would need transport? We're still struggling with transport for poor children who are wholesome. But what more about these children? Thank you.
Can you say a little bit about this iron of Eastern Cape closing? Is it a matter of this concurrent? How can you have this big crisis? And you find that it is happening again in Tampa. I think it is representative of the school rather than the school of the Islam. It's very true that after in the border of has been closed. What could be the last month? Is there anything that some of us registered don't know about? Is it because the National Department hands are tied because they have their own thing?
Thank you very much, Chief. Firstly, let me start with Mr. van der Heever's question it was a comment, but we will intensify the work in our bid. One of the things that we're looking at is not just the provision of facilities, but the matter of staff is very important, particularly in the hostels that you say. Well, across, because we need assistance in the classroom, but we are looking at that. And the view that we've taken, which is why we now have gone back to get out the 135 schools, is that each one of those 135 schools must, in the bits that we have now, the special schools, be catered for in as a way of responding to the audit report. So not just to provide certain, services that do not meet what has come out. It is true that the more rural provinces have taken this up very seriously, but that's where the need is. As I said at the beginning, the children who have been excluded from the services are more your children who are found in poorer communities or in rural communities. As it stands, 47% of the children who are being catered for are catered for in Gauteng and in the Western Cape. So, there is provision in those, but they need to do more, you are right. In terms of the three types of schools, let me go back and say, as you rightly point out, that the policy is about moving towards ensuring that each child is educated to the extent possible in a local school, so that no children are removed from their parents unless it is absolutely necessary. So the first, and how we are guiding the system is through the document that I call, the acronym is CIAS, but it is Screening, Identification, Assessment, and Support of Learners. And we have trained, we've trained all districts. We've trained to date, because we finalized it at the end of last year, we've trained about 2,000 educators, but it is for every school to be able to apply the document. And what it does, and it makes it very clear, that children who are at this level can go into a mainstream school and be supported today. Because part of the bid and part of the process to date has been to strengthen support from districts, for learners. And therefore, yes, there is clear guidance given to all the provinces, to all districts, in relation to where the children should be placed. And that is through what we call the CS document. Mema Sangwane talks about something that is indeed, may have not been a concern when we started, or we may not have seen it clearly, but what we've done also in that area was to learn from others who have gone the inclusion route. And a realization that we may have come a bit late to is how you cannot expect special schools that are not quality special schools to also act as resource centers. And therefore we have, in a sense, separated the two functions. A school cannot be a resource center unless it meets the requirements of a quality, because we don't want, and that is your question, and that I'm responding to, we are truly appreciative of that element, and we are trying in the upgrading of special schools not to expect them to act as resource centers before they are ready and they are fully functional as quality special schools. Now, secondly, you and therefore not all special schools are moving towards being resource centers immediately. You talked of the question of transport and lack of facilities, major focus in special schools provisioning. And perhaps maybe I can refer link also to Ndadewi Namo in relation to the question of transport. There is a transport policy for all schools, but you're prioritizing schools that serve the disabled. And as you can see from the report from the various provinces, because we have made it a major issue, many of the provinces have prioritized giving transport services. We'll intensify that through the bids that we've been given. And the facilities, the shortage of appropriate classrooms is an area of concern which we'll be looking at. Ndadewi Namo also raised, it was a question about why we are going for inclusion and whether it's because government cannot build the schools. There are two reasons. One is that we believe very strongly that our children who have disabilities, yes, should be serviced appropriately so that they can also access quality education, but that they should not be hidden. These are children, if you were to go back to when we were coming up with the policy, some of the statements that were made by our then Minister Asman, I remember him saying our children should play together, they should worship together, they should be educated together, and therefore, as they live with us in our families, all of them together. One, it is to make our society much more accepting of difference. We are already seeing, some spillovers from a country that's not very accepting of difference in what is residing in housing right now. But I will use also a family tie. My sister's daughter, who is going blind, who's got congenital glaucoma, was born with congenital glaucoma. She's only five. People run away from her because we've seen adults running away because she peers into their shopping trolley. They think there's something wrong with her brain. There's nothing wrong with her brain. She's short-sighted. She's only wanting to see. Well, they're like all children, she's curious. But what I'm emphasizing is that we're saying our children should be visible everywhere. If they're disabled, they must be with us. But we must make sure that where they are catered for appropriately. And second, and that is what we're looking at. In relation to the training of teachers, in this one, we've gone two routes. Firstly, for all special schools, we are training teachers, and the target is to make sure we've started training teachers in special schools using the Swedish donor funds. The target is to make sure that by the end of this year, all teachers who are in special schools have been trained, at least in Braille, those who are teaching children who are blind, and in sign language, those who are dealing with the deaf and the mute. So that's a one-year program because we've got the money, the training has already started. But we're taking also a longer-term view. We have an established working group with the Dean's Forum, and part of this, the training of all teachers in inclusion is now a component of initial teacher preparation, so that all teachers, to some extent, are able to see children who need support. If they themselves cannot provide the support, they can refer the child appropriately. So that is built into teacher training. The making of classrooms accessible, and as well as the transport. those the reason why we've gone the route of accommodating those learners that we can in ordinary schools, but having full service schools, is that, you know, for those children who need some kind of adjustment to their environment, those we are proposing go to full service schools, because we cannot make all schools accessible just as it, because of the challenge of funding. Closure of schools in the Eastern Cape takes twofold. One, sometimes is over-enthusiastic application of policy, and sometimes not appropriately, because as we are saying, it's expensive to keep children in special schools. We are not proposing, the policy doesn't push for the closure of special schools. It says keep those that need to be there. One thing that I haven't mentioned is that even within the policy of inclusion, the right for parents to decide where they want their children to be still remains. So if a parent feels, I want my child in a special school, we've left that open. But what the Eastern Cape has done is perhaps to look at their own situation and perhaps interpreted the policy in some way, but we are working with them. We have been engaging with the Eastern Cape, and we are looking at what needs to be done. It definitely is not something that we would recommend, although we recognize the right of provinces to deal with situations as they face them. But the policy is clear, and children who have mild or moderate intellectual challenges need schools where they can be catered to.
Thank you, Papa. I don't know if there are any questions on the subject before we close them.
I wanted to make a follow-up
on this one.
On this one, just to find out from the last presenter.
Just to find out from you, Mavis, to how many special schools do we have in the country, and how many the province, so that we can have an idea of which province has maybe two or three or none.
Okay. And Mr. Wainamo, we then see where what I was saying about where
the essential difference between what I want to say through the OSD are the teachers getting a fair deal now, where they always say the worst paid profession. Are they getting a good deal through this OSD? And also, I see that all the agreements happening in the ELRC. We've got other bodies for it, because, you know, one of the things when you consider these salaries is also professionalism. For instance, we argued, I think, Comrade Randall argued this point correctly during the presentation by faith, where we have to strike this balance between unionism and professionalism. Are you bringing in such bodies like faith when you consider this? And I see there are only two unions that were involved in this agreement, SADU and which is the other Africa, the one? Yeah. If other unions
presume it's because of their numbers, small numbers, are not involved. How do they buy in into these agreements? I take areas, for there are areas in this country where you'll have few such teachers and you'll have predominantly and greater numbers in a profession like organization like NATO. How do they buy in if their organization was not involved in this agreement? Are they told that this is what would be happening?
If the government has paid pages, I'll be giving the page which shows the improvement. For example, that pizza M4, the maximum was 184. Now it has moved, it can go to 263. That's the pickup part. Maybe it's going to report.
I don't know if I heard him correctly. The old argument that to reach a certain level, that will take, did you say in some instances 15 years, 30 years to reach some of those levels I referred to? And that was a sticking point during the negotiation.
Again, if you improve better than good, you can take 5 years instead of being, it will have to deal.
How?
The old one. Not qualification. I'm not reading what is here. You are saying, if you call on them to come and assess, they say you are more than good, or I don't know the test yet. You are getting 3% domestic. And then you come again after next year. So every 2 years, when all the good air is getting 1 or 3, you get 6. Which means instead of getting at your top knot in 20 years, you can get it in 5, depending on what you do. The ball is in your court, not depending. Again, I think he said another improvement here. Those who are scientific, you would have reached your top knot some past 10 years ago, but would have gap. But this one is king of that city. Therefore, the sky becomes the limit. I'm just telling that one that I understand. Sorry for.
Would the argument say, for instance, somebody says, still says, even with this package, teachers are still not getting, are still getting a raw deal? Would that be a fair argument compared to other professions?
See, I mean, I think the whole presentation clearly was showing what the differences were, but I think just to take it into account, the current system doesn't recognize qualifications, accepts to give a lump sum. This agreement begins to bring qualifications as a requirement, especially in the areas of promotion. The old structure did not deal with the issue of career pathing very clearly. This one deals with it. The old structure limited your movement up the scales. This one doesn't do. So, I mean, I've gone through all that, but I think the key answer or the key response that member wants to hear is other than getting a good deal. Our view is absolutely they're getting one of the best deals in the public service. And that is why when we reached the deadlock and we threatened to go to PSCBC, the unions were aware that this is better than the health OSD, better than the other, the sectoral bargaining. But here, I mean, you know, a salary is a relative issue. Enough is never enough. But educators, yes, but educators, if you compare in terms of the parity, price parity internationally, we mitigated it our teachers. It turns on the competitors of the society that they work in are one of the best paid in the world. And secondly, in terms of PPP, even compared to other countries, our educated remuneration structure, it's the purchasing power parity. So you don't compare the £50,000 in Britain with the 100,000 rand in South Africa. You don't say that. You don't convert the pound into rand. What you do is you say, how much can that £50,000 buy you?
in terms of housing, clothing, food, and the same thing in terms of brotherhood. So South African people are better off than the society that they live in. In fact, they are best compared to society. All you need to do is to compare the socioeconomic conditions of South African teachers to the communities they teach as compared to any other teachers and the communities they teach in the world. So, yes, and they're even now getting a better particular deal. If you look at it, it says CTU SATU and CTU SAU. So CTU means Combined Trade Union. They act within the council as a combined trade union. So NATU acts together with the South African Owners Union, together with PEU, and the TOSA, in the chamber. SATU and the Cape Professional Teachers Union act together. They've got more problems because the union themselves has to work out their own position between the four parties. So they break up into their caucuses, then each union breaks up into their own caucus, they come together as four, and then they come together. So, but I mean, the issue is that they do have a say and they've been part of the process. On the professionalism issue, I'm not sure I got the question, but all I know is that these are conditions of service. When it comes to those particular methods, for example, the professional development, etc., considerable work is being done with faith around the teacher framework.
But what I want to know, when you assess a teacher, it's all on the mechanical part of it, that is, how many figures in terms of people that have passed. That's what you assess, leaving behind what I call professional behavior of such teachers.
We have standards in terms of the performance standards and criteria under which teachers are evaluated. Part of it starts off with classroom management. So, for example, the classroom conditions, are there charts, is the classroom need, things that the teacher themselves can control. Secondly, the next standard is around the record people. Are the records in order? Is the curriculum of the year broken down into manageable elements per quarter? Do they have preparation? Then the issue of record keeping, instead of planning, do they have the assessment book, the CTU, learners' assessment file, portfolio, right up to the teaching methodology in terms of whether they're able to make the lesson exciting, etc. So those standards are there, and the input is given by the education profession itself. I think SAFE doesn't play a content role. What SAFE needs to do is they arbitrate between what is professionalism and not. Often they're able to arbitrate. But in the construction of this, the profession plays a great and major role.
Yeah, I think Christian said about the
and I'm told you are all invited for lunch in the old assembly. I think the church says in the first place you are all invited. And just one proposal from there is a group. As you know, when we move around this school for our overhead, one of the greatest parts from school is the paperwork that goes with school. That they have to find eyes. There is a group that has found a solution to that, who want to come and make a presentation before the committee. And because of our time perspective, this time that we have is not that much. I was wondering whether you want to report it.
instead of starting at 10, next week we start at 9:30 to accommodate. Is that a proposal? This group is coming with some kind of this technological thing. If you are trying to say if the schools would have to